بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
لله الأسماء الحسنى ندعوه بها، لله الأسماء الحسنى ندعوه بها.
So our topic tonight is called cultural relevancy. And cultural relevancy, the fact that we're even having a conversation about this means that our community has been culturally, or at least partially culturally irrelevant, right? And this discussion is something we hear about every year, multiple times a year, at every Muslim conference in the country and in Canada. So we should start off with that concept. Second thing is that we've come to this room, right, to identify what are the snags or what are the sources of conflict, if there are sources of conflict, that have led to this cultural irrelevancy. And what one thing we should understand is that, or at least what I'm positing, is that our situation is such that we have a larger group, what's called the group of hegemony, right? The hegemonic group is the group of privilege, the group that has the primary source of power in the community. And then you have smaller groups within that context, right? And those smaller groups end up actually wasting their time fighting with the dominant group in the community. Okay, so say you have a masjid, it's run by X, Y, and Z type of people. You feel that that masjid is culturally irrelevant. There's a small group of people that go to the masjid and are always trying to push the masjid to move or shape itself differently. The hegemonic community is those who run the masjid, and the smaller individuals who are trying to push it forward are kind of the minority group. Okay, everybody follow? So, really quickly, hopefully this room, and I'm asking you this because we all need to hear everybody's voice here. We all need conversation to happen. Hopefully this group here will be able to continue a self-examination and an examination of the society in which we live, right, through our conversation, so that we can continue to shape a vision that is both true to Allah's principles and to social or cultural relevancy. In short, this panel will be an experiment in the deconstruction of the baggage that we all bring to our communities. So with that said, I'll pass it on to my co-moderator, Sister Amira, if you could introduce panelists.
Check, okay. Assalamu alaikum. Just going to go over a few ground rules for the discussion, inshallah, and then go through some biographies of our panelists. The rules for the meeting: do not interrupt, do not react, reflect before you respond, take time to understand the other. Each panelist is going to have about 7 minutes to talk, then we're going to open it up for discussion and Q&A. And we're waiting on one more person, I think, Imam Mujahid from California, so we're going to be on the lookout for him as well. And if we see him, we're going to wrap up the discussion and give him some time on the panel, inshallah. So I will start with the biographies. Starting at the end here, Amir Suleiman is a poet, spoken word artist, writer, two-time HBO deaf poet, and teacher from Upper State New York. He is a second-generation convert. Daoud Waleed is currently the executive director of the Michigan chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. His conversion to Islam was largely influenced by late 80s hip-hop and Malcolm X. Haider Shah has been teaching for the last few years at several Islamic schools in New Jersey, New York, and California. He is a first-generation American Muslim and the son of immigrant parents. Safiya Abdullah is a spoken word artist, activist, mother, and former teacher who lives in Maryland. She converted to Islam 37 years ago. So with that, we'll just pass the mic to Brother Amir, inshallah.
Number five? We got it. Thank you. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد الفاتح لما أغلق وخاتم لما سبق نصر حق والحق والهادي إلى صراطك المستقيم على آل حقك أجره ومقداره العظيم. السلام عليكم. How are you? الحمد لله. Thank you for having me here. As she said, my name is Amir Suleiman, and my profession is in the profession of culture and creating culture and influencing culture and being influenced by culture, contributing to the cultural conversation of America, and particularly the hip-hop generation. The primary issue, I think, and I want to get straight to the point, even though this probably isn't going to seem like I'm getting straight to the point, is that the major ailment, the major dysfunction, is really the major dysfunction with any human activity, whether it be inter-family, inter-community, international, or interpersonal, is the issue of sincerity. The reason I think this issue of sincerity is the primary issue is because in some of our communities, we are not encouraged to be ourselves. In fact, we're discouraged from being ourselves. And we're encouraged to be something or someone else, this kind of abstract construct of what a Muslim is, instead of dealing with the lived realities of where and when we are. We are trying to carbon copy from another place and another time. Trying to carbon copy an identity or carbon copy a cultural engagement from another time or another place will never work. And it never has to work. It never has worked in the Muslim world. It's never worked in anywhere ever. But because of the lack of sincerity on our part, we spend a lot of time trying to fool other people, the other people in our community, and pretending, and we have like a Muslim face, and then we have another face. We have a Muslim self, we have another self. In my particular tradition, is a great thinker and intellectual, W.E.B. Du Bois, and he mentioned this phenomenon in the black consciousness, this two-faced reality that the black person was having to live. So there was one way he would be when he was around black people, but then he had to create this whole other personality in order to engage with the larger society, the more powerful society. In this context, we're talking about white America. What that dysfunction does sometimes, though, is that the person gets to pretending so often that not only do they fool, which they're aiming to do, they're successful in fooling the larger society, but the great dysfunction happens when they end up fooling themselves. And they spend so much time imitating and pretending to be something that by the time they're looking for themselves, they're nowhere to be found. In one of the greatest pieces of American writing, an essay called Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson. He says, what does Emerson say? He says, there comes a time in every man's education that he comes to know that imitation, that envy is ignorance, imitation suicide. I hope I didn't goof that quote up. But envy, ignorance, imitation suicide. Envy is ignorance. And mind you, that both of these envy and imitation are dealing with a lack of sincerity, a lack of being oneself, or in the pursuit of even knowing who oneself is. That envy is ignorance because every community, every person, indeed every creation, has a particular role in that human society, in the ecosystem, in the financial world, in the cultural world, whatever world this applies. I'm a poet, so I always view it in the context of poetry. It's just the way my mind works. And all of the scriptures, or the primary scriptures, say if we just say the Abrahamic scriptures, God is always mentioned about speaking the universe into existence. Let there be light. He said, let there be light. And that was the first act of creation in the Christian scriptures. In the Islamic scriptures, in
there is the kun fayakun, there is the be. And it is spoken. The language could have been that God fashioned the universe with his hands, like he did Adam, or alayhi salam, or that he poured the universe into existence, or that he raised it up or pushed it down, or whatever. Many other ways the imagination could find for how the creation is happening, how it came to be. But it is be. And even in the word universe in English, you find two words. You find uni, meaning one. You find verse, meaning word, a poem. That the whole of the universe is a poem. The whole of the universe is one verse. And in a verse, as a writer, every line, every metaphor, every word has its function. And say the seventh line can't say to me, as the poet, I don't want to be the seventh line, I want to be the ninth line. Like, no, you have to be the seventh line because you have a specific function in the poem. But the ninth line is so much prettier, or you know that little thing that you do, I really like that, I want to be the ninth line. But you can't be the ninth line. And in fact, the ninth line won't even have the power of the ninth line if you don't do the seventh line right. Like, I created you to do this thing in particular. And if you don't do that thing in particular, then not only are you ruining oneself, yourself, but you begin to ruin the poem. So all of us are a line of poetry in the one verse, in the grand universe. You know, it's really spectacular. This is really spectacular. That in all of the creation, there's only one of you. You are an event that's never happened before and that never will happen again. And if we give value to something because of how precious it is, how rare it is, then how rare is something? Not one in a million, or one in a billion, or one in a trillion, or one in numbers that we don't have words for. That once ever in the whole creation of everything, you're an event that's never going to happen again, and has never happened before. And if this is the case, then how precious is your unique self? So your smile, he says envy is ignorance, imitation, suicide. So say your smile, right? Say you don't like your smile. Say like, I think like Dawood is cooler than me, and I say, man, look at the way Dawood smiles. And I say, I want to smile like him. So I throw away my smile and I smile like him. And I say, man, that brother Trent, I like the way he walks. I'm gonna leave off my walk the way he walks, right? And then I'll get rid of my walk and replace it with a Trent walk. And I go like this down the line. Or say I want to be, I don't know, 2 Chainz or Drake or something, right? And I want to like be because I think they are better than what I am, right? So if I keep doing that and I got a Drake walk instead of an Amir walk, then what happens to Amir's walk? Where does it go? There's only one. Where does it go? You know where it goes. Envy is ignorance, imitation, suicide, that by imitation I've destroyed my walk. It will never exist in the universe because there was only one event that was happening ever. So my walk disappears. My laugh disappears. My sense of humor disappears. My way of dressing disappears. All of it disappears, and I have destroyed myself. Worse than just destroying my body, I've destroyed my actual self. And I say, the universe, I, as a citizen of the universe, have the right to see your smile and see your smile as a unique event that has happened in the creation of creation. And if you don't show me your sincere smile, your sincere self, I dare say you are an oppressor, for you are robbing me my right as a citizen of the universe to witness this once-in-a-lifetime event. I'm talking too long. Envious ignorance, imitation, suicide. So the more that we are sincere with ourselves in dealing in our time and our place in the reality of our culture and the boundaries and the requirements of living in here and now, I think we'll be better off in a more functional society, community, and able to contribute more successfully and more beautifully to the larger community.
I talked too long. It was a long time.
Okay, sorry for talking. Pardon me, please.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وأفضل الصلاة وتم التسليم على سيدنا ونبينا وعظيمنا وحبيب قلوبنا أبي القاسم محمد الأمين. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المصطفين وأصحابه المنتجبين وتابعين لهم بخير وإحسان إلى يوم الدين. وأما بعد، ثم يقول الله سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه الكريم بعد أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: المؤمنون والمؤمنات بعضهم أولياء بعض يأمرون بالمعروف وينهون عن المنكر ويقيمون الصلاة ويؤتون الزكاة ويطيعون الله ورسوله أولئك سيرحمهم الله إن الله عزيز حكيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم. أيها الأحباب، السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. I don't really have much more to say than what my beloved brother Amir just said. But I read this ayah of the Quran for a reason as it pertains to this subject, so I will translate it. The believing men and the believing women are maintainers and protectors of each other. They enjoin what is good and right. They deter or forbid that which is not right. They enjoin prayer and they pay charity and they obey Allah and His Messenger. Those who do this will receive the immediate mercy of Allah. Surely Allah is the mighty and the wise. He's the all-wise. We're talking about cultural relevancy. And I want all of us to thoroughly embrace something as a concept, and then I will explain. I would like all of us to embrace today that we are both Americans and we are Muslims. We are American Muslims, and that these two identities do not have to be competing identities, that they can have equal worth within our lives, that we are Americans and we are Muslims, therefore we are American Muslims, meaning American is the adjective describing what type of Muslim we are. That does not mean that we accept everything that is acceptable in the American culture. That does not mean that we do not have a cultural critique of America's history. At the same time, it does not mean that we try to superimpose cultures or cultural expressions here to make them the dominant expression of Islam here in America. If we understand the function of culture, culture is shaped by time and place and the environmental factors of that place. Hence, you can't transpose Iran or Pakistan or Syria into America, because that goes outside the function of what culture is. Part of the problem that we've had as American Muslims is that I believe that we have not fully, many of us, embraced our Islam within the American context, but we try to live our Islam viscerally through what goes on in the Muslim world, even if we were born here in these United States of America. The word mahruf in Arabic itself, and I mentioned this ayah, and we all know that it's wajib upon each and every one of us, al-amru bil mahruf wa nahyi anil munkar. This is wajib. The word mahruf is related to the word Arafah, which means to recognize, like we have Jabal Arafat when we make Hajj. Each cultural environment, there is mahruf. Those things that are known to bring about goodness in society is mahruf. Just like urf. In Arabic, the word urf means custom. So there is mahruf here there in America. So we as Muslims are supposed to be enjoining and helping promote the best that is already in America. And munkar is the opposite. And we are supposed to prevent or preach against and try to change those things that produce anti-socialism here in these United States of America. Imam Hussein, salawatullahi alayhi, he said, فَإِنِّي لَا يُرَي مَوْتَ إِلَّا سَعَادَ وَالْحَيَاتُ مَعَ الظَّالِمِينَ إِلَّا شِقَاوَ. It means that surely I see death, except that it is honor, and I see life with oppressors, except that it is dishonor, it is humiliation. What is the cultural context for this? I was telling the panel up here that a few years ago I spoke at a majlis at Dar al-Hikmah. It's a masjid close by here in Dearborn Heights. And I'm going to conclude with this. I spoke, and at the beginning of the majlis, there was a sheikh who gave a, first of all, there was a reading of Quran. Qari had a very beautiful voice. People were answering their phones while the Qari was reading. Assalamu alaikum. The best speech is the speech of Allah. Allahu nazala asna hadith is what the Quran says. Allah revealed the best hadith. That's the Quran. And the asqal hadith kitabullah, as Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said. People talking during the Quran. Then the sheikh gives the talk. People are still talking and whispering back and forth while the sheikh is giving his talk. Actually, he was giving the part of a lecture, I believe it was a day, when in Karbala, that Ashab al-Hussein, they were deprived and they were thirsty and couldn't get the water. This was part of the discussion. People still talking. As they dimmed the lights, you saw people putting their hands in their head like this, people wearing all black, going like this. So afterwards, I made my comments. And I said, the Book of Allah was being read, everyone's talking. The Sheikh gives a beautiful muhadara, everyone's talking until the lights are dimmed and turned down. And I said, if Imam Hussein salawatullahi alayhi were here today, I'm not sure if he'd recognize any of us being his followers. So this cultural expression then began in what he talked about, ikhlas, it lacked authenticity. And then how can we say that if we were alive during the time of the Prophet salallahu alayhi wa alayhi, if we were alive, we would have been of the with the Muhajirin and the Ansar at Ghazwat al-Badr. Or if we were alive during the time of Imam Hussein, we would have been at Karbala. Yet we don't have the sincerity to try to change what's going on in our localities. We're too scared to go into Detroit or Chicago or Red Hook in Brooklyn. Yet you talk about you're going to be at Badr or be at Karbala and you're too scared to go into the D? I mean, really. So it goes back to sincerity, but also it has to be a consciousness. We have to have ma'rifah. We have to have some spiritual knowledge and insight. Ma'rifah. Remember that word, ma'rifah. Ma'rifah is related to the word ma'ruf. Ma'rifah, ma'ruf, arafa, irf. We have to have some spiritual knowledge and consciousness for us to begin to change how we view ourselves as spiritual beings in this social political reality of the United States of America in the 21st century. I'm waiting to hear your comments after our next two distinguished speakers. Aqulu qawli hadha astaghfirullah li wa lakum.
Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. I would like to hear more وعليكم السلام, if we can have another السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. We're already running a little bit late, so I'll try to keep my comments brief. I unfortunately am the least knowledgeable and experienced among this panel, but this is kind of a unique situation where I'm the token, token on the panel. So, inshallah, bear with me. I just want to kind of touch on a couple of points, and then we'll just pass it on to the sister, inshallah. And these points, actually, they come from some of the audience members, and Brother Amir, I was speaking with him earlier today. I just want to kind of bring to light some of these issues, and then we can begin our conversation on cultural relevancy. My experience is mostly with younger students, being that I was a teacher for the last several years. And so on this issue of cultural relevancy, given my own experience being born here and kind of having to have the idea of Islam and American culture try to find a balanced mesh, one of my experiences and one thing that I see amongst a lot of the younger generation is a lack of something, which is a term that I learned from one of the people in the audience, is the act of metacognition, which, and I'm not, I can't give you a full definition of what it is, but it is the ability to be able to think about the way that you think and to think about the way that you process information. And what I've noticed in terms of understanding culture and deen and Islam is that there is a major failure in the ability to think about the way you think about things. And usually this issue comes up when there's a break in our foundation, when we have a number of pressing questions that we don't find anybody who's able to give us a proper answer. And when we have that type of an experience, then we start to wonder, well, I have all of these questions that are based on some fundamental foundations that I believed were true, but I can't find answers to these secondary questions. And so, unfortunately, what we have is we have this idea of questioning a lot of the beliefs that we have in terms of religion and culture coming from a very insecure place. I think what we need to try to transition to is encouraging a culture of metacognition. Just to give you a couple of examples, and I think I speak mainly for the immigrant community when I say this. I remember kind of growing up, one of the things that you're always told is, you should never sit in a masjid with your legs extended. Right? I mean, if you walk into a masjid and you sit in a masjid and your legs are extended, I mean, you'd be lucky to walk out without getting slapped around a few times. It's sometimes worse than blasphemy. I remember one time I fell asleep, and sometimes, when you fall asleep, you're asleep. That's it. You can't really do, you can't really control anything. I remember a brother woke me up, and, he woke me up, and I was groggy, and the only thing he had to say to me was, you shouldn't have your feet extended like this. And I was like, I don't know if you know, but I was sleeping. So this idea, as I was getting older and as I started to kind of leave my comfort zone in terms of masjids and mosques, I realized that, I started wondering, and this is just a small example, but I started wondering, where did this idea come from? And why is it completely natural for some people to believe this in some sense? Why have they adopted this idea? And why is it so important to them? And then why is it so foreign to others? I remember, a lot of times when I sit with converts, and it's not even late at night, we just walk into the masjid, and we're sitting with them, and a lot of them are just chill. They're just stretched out. They feel comfortable. It's because it's a masjid. And so one of the things, and this may not be, the case, but one of the things I started to understand and started to question about was, is it really the fact that they're more comfortable in a masjid than I am, right? Have we learned Islam in a way where we interpret it such that we're insecure about every little thing that we're doing? And so we try to adopt every minute cultural detail from overseas so as to not offend anybody else. And so this is a lack of metacognition where we adopt ideas, and also the other brothers had touched on this, that aren't our own. And a lot of times what happens is when we start to have a break in our foundation, when things start to become shaky and our iman comes into question, then we start to question everything. And that's not a healthy place to be. The other issue that I kind of feel is important, I was having a conversation with one of my senior students the other day. He just graduated high school. We were just talking a little bit. And he was telling me how one of his friends had just recently left Islam. And he was agnostic for a week or so, and then he just professed atheism. And a good friend, somebody who was, you know, a regular at the masjid and so on and so forth. And he was saying, you know, that this really shook him. That, you know, this was my brother in faith, and now he's an atheist. And so he doesn't know how to deal with that. But so he was kind of going into that experience, and he said the reason why he became atheist was because he could not get a proper answer as to how Islam deals with homosexuality. And because he couldn't get a proper answer on this one small issue, which is small relative to kind of the big picture of belief in and of itself, he left Islam. And so what I was, you know, having this, when we were having this conversation with this younger brother, one thing that I encourage him to do, and I want to bring this point because I think we need to create a culture of metacognition and a culture of honesty. What I told him was, one problem that we have in our community is, in terms of understanding culture and religion and how to balance the two, is that we are not honest about the questions that we have, and the answers that we get sometimes aren't completely honest answers. The reason being, and this is just one reason, is because we're afraid to ask questions that bring scrutiny on our level of faith. If I ask a question, for example, on where is God or how is God, I'm not going to press that question because I'm afraid that this sheikh or this scholar or this community leader or my parents even sometimes are then going to start to wonder, does this person believe? Why is he asking all these questions? Why is he asking all these questions? And on the flip side, when we give answers or when we hear answers being given, a lot of times there's again a culture of fear and dishonesty because the person who's answering the question doesn't want his or her faith to come into question. And so I think kind of moving along, you know, in terms of culture and finding a right balance, these are just two things I wanted to touch on, is the ability and the practice of understanding the things that you believe and why you believe them, and having a real sense of honesty about the questions that you have and the answers that you receive. Wa akhiru da'wan and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu ala Muhammadin wa alihi ajma'in. Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel. Okay, so I'm the last one. I have nothing to say. They said it all. Basically, I want to take it from a different perspective. As with, like, Brother Amir, although nowhere near as good, my profession is in dealing with influencing culture as a poet and also instilling culture as a teacher and a mother and a grandmother. So it's something that has been very much a part of my life. And being a convert to Islam, most of us, when we come into Islam, we are looking for the truth of Islam. We are looking for the Islam of our Rasul. We are looking for the Islam of Imam Hussein. We are looking for the Islam that is going to be established with the coming of Imam Mahdi. But we come from a place of having no knowledge because we have said, La ilaha illallah. And in doing the La Ilah, we have emptied ourselves of all of our previous beliefs, inshallah. Sometimes to an extreme. And then we go to filling it back up, filling our cup back up. So we turn to those that we perceive as having more knowledge, partially because they were born Muslim, and partially because that's what we're told. I remember doing a conference on Islam, and at that point I had been Muslim 30 years, and someone asked me, how do you deal with marriage when your parents want you to fit these certain cultural things? And I told them, the first half of my Muslim life, I had wished that I was born Muslim. The last half of my Muslim life, I thanked Allah I wasn't. Because it's two different perspectives. And this lies in the problem of cultural relevancy. Communication is a circular process. When I say something, I'm relating something to someone else, and I'm encoding it based on my experiences. But that person is decoding it based on their experiences. So if our experiences are radically different, there's a miscommunication. And this is what happens so often amongst the convert and the immigrant community. There's a miscommunication because I am encoding it based on my experiences, they are decoding it based on their experiences. When we converted to Islam, we converted because we rejected everything that this society offered. Didn't mean that we rejected who we were. We rejected the value system and the political system and the history of this society. However, when most immigrants come over, they embrace the very same things that we have rejected. So when we have a dialogue, there's miscommunications based on our experiences. These miscommunications are costing us our children. Many of our second generation children leave the masjids because of the intolerance towards being accepted as who they are, as individuals. What Brother Amir Suleiman said was so beautiful that I wish so many of them could hear this. And many of the immigrant children, once they grow up in here, they also are leaving the masjids because they don't see the relevancy to their lives. You see, as Muslims, we embrace the struggles of Palestine, the struggles of Somalia, the struggles of Sudan, the struggles of any place you want to go. Yet we don't embrace our own struggles. When my sons go out into the street every day, I wonder, will they return? So we go to demonstrations for Palestine. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but we go there. But when we go to demonstrations for Trayvon, I don't see my brothers and sisters. When we go to demonstrations for Shahid Lukman, I don't see my brothers and sisters. So then this is creating a sense of distance at a point in time where we cannot afford this distance. Because we are not embracing each other in our totality. And the reality is that there's a hadith that says everything has a zakat on it. And that zakat depends. Your zakat on money is your 2.5% in zakat. Your zakat on your body is fasting during Ramadan. And your zakat on living in a non-Muslim society is to convert 40 people to Islam. But if you don't understand the culture and the history of the society, you cannot do that. Because we're coming from a different position. And so I think this is one of the reasons that I felt that we needed to address this, is that we need to understand it is a point of awareness, spiritual awareness first, awareness of self and awareness of ego, awareness of the fact that we view everything through our own experiences and removing ourselves out of that. But to do that, you have to also be able to have knowledge. Not the knowledge in the history books, but the knowledge in the streets. And when I'm saying that, I don't mean going and hanging out on the streets. What I mean is understand what the history and the social and political structure is of this country. Because if you don't understand our story. And if you don't understand our story, you do not understand one of the beautiful events in creation. And so we fight with each other. We spend all of our time as converts until we come to that self-realization. We spend all of our time trying to be accepted. I can be Muslim 37 years, have studied overseas, doesn't matter. Because when I go in, I will have people tell me that they don't believe that I can ever really be a Muslim because I wasn't born that way. That is your issue, not mine. But it becomes my issue when it affects my children. At the same point, I have to acknowledge where you're coming from. So we have to understand each other's each other's perspectives, and that requires stepping out of your safety. As the brother said, how many of you all, and we have a serious problem. Those of you that have come here, you've heard me say this before in different workshops. Why is it that we have no institutions in the inner city? If we are following the examples of the prophets, they all went to the poor and the oppressed, the mustasifin, because who wants a solution to their life? Is it the people that are benefiting from the status quo? No, they want to stop any solution because that affects their status quo. No, it is the people who are not accepted. And every prophet went to the mustasifin. And for every prophet, those who were the status quo came to them and said, I will join your ranks if you distance yourself from those folks that ain't got no money. Okay. Let me do it. Turn it over. And so that's all I'm saying, is we have to understand each other as individuals and as brothers and sisters. Don't try to make me Pakistani, Iranian, Arab. Accept me for who I am. Accept my history. Accept and understand what has gone on and know it and then act on it. And that makes your responsibility, not just on the day of Quds, that makes your responsibility on every day that we lose our youth. And I'm past time. Sound like.
I think we're going to move to question and answer right now. So, can everybody move up just so that it feels more like a discussion and not so much like a, you know, lecture, so it can feel a little bit more embracing or something? Is that the right word? Somebody else has a mic. Okay.
Check the mic. Okay, Brother Ali here in the front has the mic on the floor. If we can get the mic turned on, please. And just wave at him. Make him come to you. Ali, Brother Ali. I got you, brother.
No, it's not on or no?
It's on now.
It's on?
Yeah. Brother Abu Hassan has a comment to make. Comments, it's not just question and answer. Comments, it's a conversation. We want to talk to each other to understand each other.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. My first comment is, one of the learned people of yesteryear, he was speaking to his son, and his son said that when I grow up, I want to be like you. And his father, he shook his head and he was pretty sad and distraught. He said, oh, my son, when I was your age, I wanted to be like Imam Jafar as-Sadiq alayhi salam, and this is all that I achieved. So if you want to be like someone, be like the Masumin alayhi salam, alayhim salam. That's my first comment. And I'm just, because, you know, I'm a convert just like you guys, and I'm hearing the things that you guys are saying, and I kind of take exception to a few of the things that you guys are saying. As far as, you know, we're not in Iran, we understand that. At the same time, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, when you look at his writings and you look at the things that he said, he was always a champion of the poor. And, you know, so when I hear these things that, you know, we're bashing people, and please correct me if I'm wrong, if I've misinterpreted what you guys are saying. When I hear that we're saying, oh, we're not Iranian, we're not Iraqi, we're not this, we're not that, we're American, we're this and we're that. Imam Khomeini, when you look at, may the mercy of Allah be upon him, when you look at the things that he said in his life, and you look at whenever the Iranians attempted to adopt some pre-Islamic ideals or attitudes, he would always tell them that, no, this is incorrect. Islam is about the universal brotherhood of mankind. So with me, when I look to the scholars, and if they happen to be Iranian or Iraqi, I don't think that denigrates who I'm trying to be. It's actually It's helping me become who I want to be. So it's not about, like I say, saying, yes, we understand that I'm American. You said that if you take your smile, if you take the brother's smile and that person's walk, you're going to lose yourself. In all actuality, if the brother's smile is better than yours, if the brother's walk is better than yours, if the brother's ideology is superior to yours, then why not take from that? Why not get something? Why not gain? So that's just my, you know, that's my position, because a lot of Americans, you know, they'll say things like, oh, you know, I'm American, I'm this and I'm that. And I'm like, yo, you know, when you guys are talking about metacognition, yes, there is a book by David Bohm. He spoke about metacognition. Now, we also have our issues. I was explaining one time in our community that a few years ago, a Yemeni brother asked me to marry his sister. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I was like, nah, I'm good. And the reason why I was good, because in my head, I'm automatically assuming that, yo, you're cool with me because, you know, you're my boy, but your father, your uncle, your grandfather, and your whole family's not going to accept me. So this is why I was like, no, that was my own baggage. So we have our own metacognition as well, issues. And thank you. Please forgive me. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam. Maybe I didn't make myself clear in the communication. When I was talking about being Imani, well, nobody's talking about the examples of Imam Khomeini. We all embrace that. I'm talking about, don't tell me that my marriage ceremony is not complete without a mirror, and that I have to put out a goldfish and grass on my table on the 21st of March for Nowruz. That's what we're talking about. That the cultural aspects of those countries, not the examples of Imam Khomeini, because even Imam Khomeini commented about you cannot raise your youth, your children, in the culture that you grew up in. You cannot impose on them the same culture that you have, because society evolves, time evolves and changes. And so it's not ever denying the scholars like Imam Khomeini and the leaders that we have overseas. It is denying the cultural practices being imposed in that manner, is what I was saying. So I apologize if that was not communicated correctly.
And I think I can mention, I'm going to make an assumption here, that no one is saying that, you know, to have a Persian teacher or to have someone from, like, for example, for myself, my teacher, my sheikh, is not from America. And I take from him and I take everything from him. So it is not to say that that can't be. And my sheikh is teaching me how to be me, not how to be him. So, for example, and I think a lot of converts can, and yourself maybe as well, depending on when you accepted Islam and where you were, but you would hear someone say something like Muslim food. They didn't mean hot dogs, even if it was halal. They say Muslim dress. They don't mean just that your covering was to be covered. They're speaking of a particular cultural dress from a particular country. And when they were mentioning any of these things, they were never talking about Brooklyn or Miami, or it was always something somewhere else. So what it created in a lot of people was this dysfunction that their culture, American culture, was somehow devalued, or they couldn't be as Muslim being American. The only way you could really be really Muslim is to be someone else. So I think that's the general idea. But like I said, my teacher is African, for example. So it's not saying, oh, this person has a Iranian teacher and, you know, this person doesn't know himself or love himself, or this person's teacher's from Pakistan, he must not know himself or love himself. That's not what I mean at all. In the issue also about the diaspora or the ummah, and I think this is what, you know, our esteemed brother Daoud was mentioning, is that if you're really concerned about the poor, how are you walking over the poor outside your door to talk about poor people 1,000 miles away? What does that say about us as a community that we don't we say these poor people are not as valuable as these other poor people, and you will step over this poor person, and I don't know any of the ayama that was stepping over poor people to talk about other poor people thousands of miles away. So if the issue is really about poverty and about the universality of brotherhood, then what about brothers, like he said, in Red Hook, Brooklyn, or right here in Detroit, or right on the south side of Chicago? Why are those issues, you know, when a black youth is killed by the police, why doesn't that inspire that need for justice and, you know, for us to speak out against the oppressor? Oh, that's just a nigga. That's what niggas do. Niggas die. So that's not an issue. But this other 12-year-old boy in this other place somewhere else, oh, we'll weep for him. And we'll cry for him, and we'll send money to his family, and we'll pray, and we'll come together, and we'll speak truth to power. But niggas, niggas, nah.
I concur with what both of them have said. I'd like to remind us of something that's a authentic hadith. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, he was with his companions and he was going to make tawaf around the Kaaba. And he went to go salute al-Hijr al-Aswad. And he looked at it, he looked at al-Kaaba, and he said, al-mu'min adamu hurmatan min al-Kaaba. The soul of one believer is more mighty and precious with Allah than the Kaaba itself. Any Muslim, any believer. And I think that sometimes as reverts, there's a little pushback, or sometimes there's a little, what can be seen as a little tenseness when we talk about not imposing or superimposing foreign culture, as Sister talked about, on American Muslims as the authentic expression of Islam, is because a lot of us have been relegated as second-class Muslims. That's a reality. I've studied Islam formally myself and gotten ijazah from some scholars. And I'll have a person who comes looked at me, because they were born in the Middle East, look at me as if I have no ilm, no Islamic knowledge, as if they lived in this country and they got the real Islam via osmosis. Y'all know what osmosis is, right? It's a scientific term. So we've experienced this. So I understand this, and this is part of the issue that we have to deal with in a balanced way. At the same time, it's not also appropriate, and as you mentioned as well, there is another extreme when people get into what I call immigrant bashing, because everyone doesn't have this mindset. And as you mentioned, like the Yemeni, alhamdulillah, these people could, the family could be mutaqeen. They may not have this type of like asrul jahiliya mindset, and just because you're black, you're inferior. But many of us have this reaction because we have ran to this so many times, because we have gone into stores and been called abdi. I've been called abdi before. The guy didn't even know I knew Arabic. He called me and said, watch that slave right there. So a lot of us have experienced that. So sometimes we have these types of these misconceptions, and we as reverts, black American, white American, Latino American, because we've experienced this so much, that we sometimes unjustly impose this upon Muslims who immigrate here. So I jazakallahu khairan for your comment, brother.
I just want to mention one other thing, just 2 minutes. Also, I think I'm glad that you brought up the point, as I'm thinking about it more, the point that I wanted to push forward is not about necessarily my blackness or my Americanness. Is really to open for a person from wherever they're from. For example, if a person is like second generation, then it's natural for them to have some cultural, and that's beautiful, and that's what makes America beautiful. You seen The Godfather? Have you seen The Godfather? I'm going to reference The Godfather. Is that a waste of time? Is it a waste of time? Okay, so in The Godfather, you know, The Godfather opens up, Godfather 1 opens up where there's a, it's a wedding, right? And you know, the Godfather's back there, he's taking all the guests, and you know, they're having a wedding. It's like this big Italian wedding. Then the beginning of the second one starts with the naming ceremony for Michael Corleone's son. And that's when the senator is there, when they're talking about going to Vegas and all of that. I don't know if this is a waste of time. Anyway, one of the issues in the film was that, in the contrast, was that the Italian ceremony of those first-generation Italian immigrants, it was very Italian. And the music was very Italian. The food was very Italian. And that's good and it's beautiful. By the time the second generation came, you see them trying to tell the people in the band like how to play Italian music, and they're playing like Yankee Doodle Dandy and like Whistling Dixie and stuff like that. And the people are like, you know, and the food, they say, man, who made this food? This isn't real Italian food. And they were, but that was signifying the transition of the Italian American community and what was happening to the culture. So I'm not saying you have to be American the way I'm American, because our American experience is different. So I want, when I come to your house, I want to have the food. That's the whole, that's the exciting thing about this whole American experiment. When I come and have iftar at your house, I don't want to have hot dogs and hamburgers. If I come to your house and you give me hot dogs and hamburgers and fried chicken, I'm going to be upset. I'm like, I can do this at my house. So I want to be able to share in your culture. So if it's second generation, third generation, and preserving your culture and working hard to preserve your culture, because America will whitewash you, you know? And I was in Belgium. I'm doing this again. That's just 2 minutes. I was in Belgium. And the others in Belgium are Moroccans, right? And I was talking with a Moroccan guy. His father was born in Morocco, emigrated there, working class people, like most of the Moroccans there. And he said his father was talking to his grandson, so his nephew. And the father's saying something to the son in Arabic, and the boy, he must be 4 years old, 5 years old, turns to his mother and says, what is this old guy talking about? He doesn't even understand the language. The old man started to weep. He said, if I knew this, I would have rather been poor in Morocco than had to suffer this humiliation. So it's not to say become American, be more American, and that's the true way, the way I'm American. Because, for example, even a black American and a Latin American or like a Irish American, all of those are different experiences. So to hold on and to work hard to preserve the uniqueness of your culture, that was also what I was seeking to emphasize, that what you have is unique and special, and it's something I don't have, and the only way that I can experience it is if you hold on to it. So I it's in my best interest for you to hold on to your culture.
Assalamu alaikum. There was a point that was made about, you know, this is America, you know, you bring Pakistan here, you bring Yemen here, whatever, and I think that's the point of America, right? The point of America is made up of all these different countries, all these different people, even if you bring it back to the slave trade. I mean, even black Americans, they're not from America. So this country is made up of people bringing whatever it is that was of their place to America. And I think there's a lot of conversation about, you know, this, and this is, you know, this started, you know, really from Dr. Sherman Jackson, this idea of the indigenous Muslims versus the immigrant Muslims. And we talk a lot about immigrant, you know, the immigrants and the indigenous, right? That's where we get lost. That's where the first, second, and third generation Muslims get lost. Like, I was born and raised in Brooklyn. Does that make me an immigrant, or am I indigenous? Mm-hmm. And I think the way that it's been portrayed is that I'm not an indigenous, that I come from an immigrant family, so I must have an immigrant mentality. So I think that's the divisive language, and that's where our community does, there is no unity, because we have separated ourselves into these different labels, right? So I could be Palestinian, I could be Muslim, and I can be American, whatever American means to me, and whatever it means to every individual person in this room. And I think that's the issue. Mm-hmm. And I also want to make the point that we need to highlight some of that good work and the evolution of our community, right? So when we talk about inner city and where the Muslims are at, one example, so I don't take too long. You're looking at Iman in Chicago. Iman is in inner city. They're doing re-entry programs for prisoners. They're doing social services and medical services to uninsured, mostly blacks and Latinos, and mostly not Muslims, showing the generosity of what Islam teaches us as Muslims. And they're just one example of people doing this across the country. Mm-hmm. Day of Dignity, that's being implemented across the country on multiple days, where Muslims are going out and doing community service in communities other than their own. So I think we've grown as a community, and I think we have to find language that unites us. And there's this other conversation about this idea of, like, the immigrants are come here and they're the elite, and we come middle class. I don't know what immigrants you guys know, but the immigrants that I know that are coming to this country are struggling in communities across the country, from Pakistan, people fleeing places of conflict in Syria and parts of the Arab world and parts of Southeast Asia. So let's figure out how to talk about unity, and also not to allow people to choose what part of their identity they want to talk about. For me personally, my Islam is all mingled up with my Palestinianness and my Arabness. It's something I can't separate. So how do we embrace that versus saying that, you know, that's cultural, let's keep that over there, and this is Islam, let's keep Islam here. I think that that's a conversation we need to learn to have. And how do we bring in these young people without saying, oh, you guys, you're a son of Pakistanis, you're a son of immigrants, I'm a indigenous Muslim, and I'm, you know, black Muslim, I'm, you know, whatever it is. I mean, we're all Muslims, we just come from different experiences, and we have multiple identities. And how do we embrace all of our identities in a conversation that unites us?
Bismillah. I think all of your points are good points, and I've worked with, like, for example, with Iman for years and some of the organizations in California and different parts of the country. I think part of the reason that you hear, like, Dr. Sherman Jackson and some other people talk in this way, one is just a cultural and just a historical reality about class and immigration, and it's not even necessarily anyone's fault. It's just, you know, it's just what happened. And I think the reason you're here, and this is why I stopped to make the comment that I made just before you spoke, because I don't want it to sound like I'm a black American Muslim and that somehow means you have to strip your Islam of your Palestinianness or your Arabness or your Pakistanness. No, that's not. That's the beauty, I think. That's the beauty of Islam. So when you go to China and you see some things that only Muslims in China do because of whatever cultural and historical realities that they faced, I like that. So I like going to a wedding and it doesn't look like an American wedding. Like, I enjoy that. I think what a sister was having and some other people take issue is when someone imposes that. So my Palestinianness and my Arabness is all mixed together with my Islam. So when I tell you something is halal haram, I'm speaking sometimes as a Muslim, sometimes as an Arab. You know what I'm saying? And then it's like, oh man, and if I don't know any better, then I'll think Arabism is Islam, and then I'll get confused. And sometimes that can be destructive. And that the African American community, for example, was establishing an Islam in America and basically in a leadership position in America. I'm not going to go down that road, actually. So I love it. I love the Arabness of your Islam. I love the Pakistaniness of someone else's Islam. I love the Malaysianness of other. And I've traveled around the world, and I love witnessing it. And I come and sit, and I ask a whole bunch of questions: what kind of food, and what kind of this, and what influenced this, and all that. I love it. I love it. I think it's just the issue of feeling imposed upon. And I think what you're hearing from some of the convert community, and I don't want to use divisive language. It's just. Because all the language that's coming to our mind is problematic. I'm gonna have faith in us, okay? I'm gonna say some things that may be problematic, but I'm gonna have hope that we all love each other. So you understand where I'm coming. And I'm just seeking to be sincere and just really be frank and sincere, so that we can start to solve some of these things. Many brothers and sisters felt very much insulted. They felt, because of this, like the brother was saying, like second-class Muslims. That's just the way that they felt. Whether it was meant, whether it was a constructed plan, we don't think there's some sort of like Arab Desi secret society Muslim, you know, gathering where they say, we're going to get these black people. Like, I mean, I know we know that's not happening. It's just a matter, like you said, your stuff is all one thing. And like for me, bean pie is Muslim food, you know? Like, when I was growing up, if a woman didn't know how to make bean pie, if you were Muslim and you didn't know how to make bean pie, it's like, what kind of Islam is that? But if I grew up all the way, say if I was this age and I had that feeling, and I look at you and say, sister, where's your bean pie? I don't even know what bean pie is. Stuck, fiddler, you don't know what bean pie is. It's not. I know you know because you're from Brooklyn, but I'm saying, if that was to make a silly example of that, and then I made you feel bad, like you weren't really Muslim because you ain't never even heard of bean pie.
bean pie before, you know? And that would affect you and affect your children, affect your self-esteem and your feeling of self-worth and feeling of God loves you. I mean, this stuff goes deep. It's like, God may not love me. I may not get into paradise because I don't know how to make bean pie. As ridiculous as that sounds, there's brothers who's like, I eat Muslim food. And what they mean by that is something from somewhere else. And they feel like that affects their relationship with God. As silly as it sounds, that's a real, real thing. So I think in trying to like break some of that, you may hear brothers or sisters use language that is, maybe they go a little overboard or it seems a little extreme, you know what I mean? But that's really where it comes from, them trying to themselves break those chains and help other people feel free to be like, man, my Muslim food is like hamburgers and like bean pie, like that's real, and like bean soup, and like that's like Muslim cuisine to me, and that's and God still loves me, you know, like that. There was a brother who said he was Muslim for 10 years. He said, I didn't know that I could pray. He saw a brother pray with, he had his baseball cap, he turned it around, he was praying. He said, I didn't even know God could hear me when I was wearing it. Think about what's happening in that man's heart, you know what I mean? Like, he's thinking, like, unless I dress in a way other than myself, God is not hearing me. It's neurotic, the person's mind is broken, you know?
I'll make a quick comment, and I agree with what Sister Linda said. That there's a lot of great things going on. I think that what a lot of us are saying, that there's a development in our community where it takes time for us to grow, and also takes active cultivation. So Iman is a beautiful example of what's going on in Chicago and Ummah Clinic. We want to get to a point where those exceptions are the rule, because those are exceptions, they're not the rule. Another thing is that I'm always big, for those of you who know me, I like to talk about privilege. We all need to recognize our privilege and release our, and use our privilege to empower other people. Like, as a male, I have male privilege in the Muslim community. I can do certain things that sisters can't do. That's real. That's real talk. Same thing, if you are an immigrant or children of immigrants, you have a type of authority where you go into a masjid in a Muslim community, no one questions your Islam. No one questions whether you're really Muslim or not. Whereas us, many times we're questioned about the legitimacy of our Islamic practice or our Islamic knowledge, and I hear it all the time. So I challenge you all to first recognize your privilege and then work to undo that, or to help empower other people through your privilege to help get rid of those misconceptions and that attitude that we have of a type of caste system or second-class Muslimness in our community, because if you didn't know existed before, let me tell you, it exists.
I just had a kind of a, I guess it's a fluff question, but and we're talking about culture, and like, culture encapsulates a lot of things. Obviously, religion becomes a part of culture, art, food, right? We're talking about all these topics. So in terms of the American culture, not that there is one like specific definition of the American Muslim culture, but that there are certain things that we share, that there is a cultural relativism, where, I mean, and I'm going to share a story. This might, I don't know if it'll go a little long, but I'll try and shorten it. But the history of how Islam came to India, because it was not part of the original expansion, the Iranians brought it over. They looked at the cultural practices of the Hindus and of the native Indians there, and they adjusted. And it was a Shia Islam, but I mean, the fact that if you go into a Desi Shia center and compare it to an Iranian or an Arab center, there is a difference. And you'll see it because of the adopted cultural customs, but it was only so that the acceptance of Islam was more palatable, and it did not take away from the quality of their Islam. So in that sense, if we've done it once before, what's stopping us from doing it here? And where are the relative, you know, places where we can make the parallels? That's my question.
Uh,
I'm not going to answer the question. I'm going to leave that to the panelists to maybe think about it. But I wanted to throw a wild card in really quickly because I think the conversation was becoming immigrant indigenous. But from my experience, and I think maybe some others on the panel might have the same thing, my experience was coming in to an immigrant quote-unquote community, right? But then being adopted by, my teacher was African American. And so then I was pushed and pulled between two, because I'm neither one, I was pushed and pulled between two sets of cultures, quote-unquote, and two sets of concerns, and I was like, man, I don't fit either one, right? So we can talk about what you're mentioning, how can we piece together stuff, but I think it's going to be, it's not going to be racial, maybe. And it's not just going to be socioeconomic. It's going to be like, I don't think anybody can answer that yet. It's going to be so complex because, like you said, there is this dynamic cultural existence here in the U.S. that there's something that we have to delve into and see what is an American mindset? Does that exist? What is an American spirit or something like that, perhaps? I just wanted to throw that out there for the panelists to comment on.
You know, the thing is when you talk about an American mindset, I will look at my family. I'm Norwegian and Chippewa. My children's father was African American and Choctaw. So we have within our family a dichotomy of different cultures. And even amongst two Native American tribes, we do things differently. We eat differently. But there is an embrace in everything there. And I think that's all we're asking for. There is no one mindset because we all have different experiences. Let's look at the U.S. Census Bureau when we're talking about privilege. U.S. Census Bureau of 2010 released the figures that the net worth of the Caucasian in America is in excess of $113,000 per person, Caucasian. The net worth of an Hispanic in America is in excess of $6,300. The net worth of an African American is less than $5,700. Don't tell me that there is not an institutional stratum. And what we see is that people who are not aware of the situation truly draw conclusions that represent people incorrectly. And so when we talk about an American stratum, like you said, everyone has different experiences. So there is no American stratum. You know, I'm going to interpret it. My mother-in-law was driven off the reservation by drive-bys in the 30s. When they changed the laws to say white men could now buy property on the reservation if the head of the household died. So literally, you talk about drive-bys, you have a concept in your mind of in the inner city ghetto, but it started on the reservation where whites would drive through the reservation shooting people. Women holding their children hanging laundry. Okay, she had to leave because her father and her uncles were killed. This is a dichotomy that we deal with in our family, because that, in essence, robbed us of our material value. And so there are a lot of, yes, I have splinters on my shoulder. I have chips on my shoulder that have become splinters. And I acknowledge that. And there are times when I have gone in and had to deal with different things with immigrant Muslim and was ashamed of myself because of the splinter I had on my shoulder. Because when they started questioning me about my Islam, I'm thinking they're questioning me the way I get questioned all the time. But in reality, the brother flipped the script, and I was in tears. So yes, we do. It is a self-defense mechanism that we have in dealing. My son studied overseas in Qom 5 years, took the test, could wear the imamah, walks into the masjid he grew up in, looks for the masjid because they renovated it, and gets asked, why do you want to know where the masjid is? Because I want to pray. What do you mean you want to pray? Are you a Muslim? Yes. This is a 19-year-old man. Say Surah Fatiha for me. Okay, seriously. Pakistani, Urdu, Turk, Arab, Syrian, anyone walked into a masjid, would they ask him to say, a 19-year-old man, to say Surah Fatiha? So yes, we have these chips on our shoulders, and they are our baggage, that we have to work on our self-purification. I admit that. We own up to that. And you have your baggage. And the only way we're going to solve this is to deal with our own nafs and to deal with recognizing the reality that we exist in, that you exist in, that I exist in, that she exists in, that he exists in, and they're all different realities. But you see, those realities are the beautiful aspect of the dichotomy of the world. And it can be something beautiful or something ugly. And it depends on how we encode it and decode it. And I talk too much.
Yeah, is this maybe one more question? We'll do one more question, and then we're going to... Which one? The sister right here? Is it Latifa over here? I don't know.
Who's it?
Assalamu alaikum. I think that, you know, we definitely had a lively discussion tonight, and I think that, you know, just as the sister said, we all have our own experiences, and I think that that's beautiful. And I think that as Muslims, we have to learn to accept that not everybody looks like us, not everybody speaks the same language as us. The Quran and Islam is what unites us. We all pray in Arabic. You know, those are things that we have to learn. So I think that we have to continually and consistently go back to Quran, Hadith, you know, what is expected. You know, the first crier for prayer was Bilal, you know, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. He didn't make any separation as far as, you know, black, this, that, whatever else. So I think that as people, we have to definitely acknowledge that. For me, you know, I'm of mixed heritage myself, you know, directly. You know, my mom is white, you know, Native American as well. My dad is black, Native American. But I think that, you know, growing up the way that I grew up, very racist grandmother, et cetera. But, you know, I just feel like this. If you got love for me, I'm going to have love for you. You know, if you don't have love for me, trust me, it's five other people that's going to have love for me. You know, I think that, you know, and I understand, you know, the forum. I totally understand that. I just think that as Muslims, with, you know, the sisters, you know, we have to, you know, definitely, you know, support, you know, basically just give love. You know, brothers too. You know, I think that I see the brothers giving more love than the sisters, but it's all right. You know, I'm trying to work on that, but it's okay. You know, y'all walk around, Assalamu alaikum, but it's okay. but maybe I'm just trying to take it, you know, on a lighter note, but I just think that, you know, as Muslims, you know, Islam is the truth. You know, I wasn't born Muslim. You know, I mean, yes, you know, people look at me, oh, well, are you really a Muslim? Are you, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it's like, look, you know, it's a process. Am I still learning? Are the people who are born Muslim still learning? Definitely. But I think that, you know, we have to, you know, get back to definitely Quran, Islam, what's written, and not, you know, think it to ourselves, you know, just like the brother was saying. I don't know, for some reason, you kept bringing up food. Every one of your examples was food. I said, man, he likes to eat. Every example, bean pie, soup, burgers, whatever. So, I said, but I just think that we have to get back to that, and I definitely, you know, have faith in our community. You know, I have faith, you know, we're definitely growing, but it's unfortunate as human beings, we always try to create division. There's not inclusion, we try to exclude. You know, this person is that, this person, and it's not just in the Muslim community, it's in every community. So that's something that's definitely saddening for me, but, you know, I just have to go back to this. You know, if you don't give me salams or if you treat me a certain way, you know, you got to deal with God on that. I don't have nothing to do with that. You know, I just have to move forward, love the people who love me, and I think that we have to have that attitude, you know, because it's going to be people who, you know, look down on you or whatever, you know, or have different beliefs or say things about you that aren't true, but Allah knows what's in our hearts. Nobody else knows that. They just see the outside. So that's just, you know, maybe that's a good closer for the event, to close the event up. I don't know. But, okay, here you go.
Yeah, I think we're going to wrap it up now. And just to reiterate, this session was, I think, created just to get people thinking outside of their own boxes and comfort zones, and not necessarily to come up with a whole bunch of solutions, because this is going to be, you know, something that is more of a, it's going to be a work in progress. And inshallah, everyone can think a little bit differently about the issue moving forward. Meet your Ummah with panelists and organizations from all over the country. Stay seated. That's coming up next, inshallah. So I don't know if we want to end with a surah. Maybe. Brother Dawood?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والعصر إن الإنسان لفي خسر إلا الذين آمنوا وعملوا الصالحات وتواصوا بالحق وتواصوا بالصبر صدق الله العلي العظيم.